If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Paul Kudinek, a.k.a. Winter Oak, is a contemporary anarchist, writer, and activist. In 2020, he became known for his outspoken criticism of the totalitarianism being rolled out worldwide on the back of the COVID crisis. He writes at Winter Oak. He declared on his blog as early as March 25th, I think, of 2020, it should now be obvious to anyone with even half a brain that we're not, in fact, facing a deadly global epidemic that threatens to wipe out millions upon millions of our fellow human beings. I think most of us sort of have figured that out by now. He penned two widely circulated articles denouncing the fourth industrial repression and analyzing in great detail Klaus Schwab and his great fascist reset. At the end of that year, he argued that the events of 2020 had demonstrated the need for a different civilizational direction. He wrote, "We need to rediscover what it means to be truly human, to cherish value over price, communal belonging over personal self-interest, honor above wealth." And Paul Kudinek joins us now. Thanks for coming on our program, Paul. Nice to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks for inviting me.
How many people do you think, or what's the proportion of people do you think who are now in, share those views that you telegraphed in 2020? How many have woken up, do you think?
It's difficult to tell, isn't it? Not more than at the very beginning, obviously. I do detect that even the people who are vehemently supportive of the restrictions and keen for us all to get the jabs have sort of know now, but they're not going to always admit it. I don't know. I suppose it must be. It's difficult to put a figure, isn't it? A large minority have woken up. Unfortunately, I think probably 60% haven't.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that's a lot of work to do still. I'm interested in the category that you've identified, criminocracy. And are you suggesting that we're kind of ruled by a criminocracy?
Yes. Well, this started out. It's a sort of line of investigation that I started because of COVID and because of what was happening. It was just so obvious that there was some entity, global entity, behind everything that was happening. Otherwise, it wasn't possible that all the same, not only the same policies, but the same propaganda, state propaganda and media propaganda, down to the same little catchphrases, build back better and the rest of it, was being rolled out everywhere. There was some coordinating entity, and that's when I started looking into it. And, I'd always sort of imagined it was all this sort of stuff came from America, really, the American Empire, USA, home to all the corporations. But I started looking into the British, into the Commonwealth, which obviously is well known in New Zealand, being the British Empire taken on a new pseudo democratic or non-threatening sort of rainbow colored form these days. And when I looked into the Commonwealth and its origins and the people behind it, started getting very sinister. And that led me into all sorts of directions. Well, to cut the story short, yes, there is an entity behind it, which is a criminal entity, because it's deliberately using the structures of and institutions of states and of international organizations in order to advance its own private agenda, seeking its own private profit and an increase in its private power that it exerts over much of the world.
So it's not a US centered thing, because that's, you kind of feel that it could be. Is it, so does that make it far more historical then? I mean, it goes back a long way.
Yes. The American Empire that we're used to seeing for the last, throughout my life, I suppose, is really a continuation of the British Empire. This is what I've discovered. And behind the British Empire were banking interests, financial interests that used the wealth and the power of the British state in order to advance its own program, which was globalization.
Yeah.
Even then. I mean, I've wrote a booklet about the Rothschilds because it's my research showed me in the end that, that the Rothschilds crop up everywhere in this story. And I didn't start off with that as an a priori assumption that it must be them because I'd, you know, heard somewhere somebody had talked about the Rothschilds. They actually kept coming up in my reading. Yep. And in the end, I focused specifically on them for a while. I discovered that it is their gang, basically, which is incredibly, incredibly, over a course of 200 years, managed to take over, not only taking over all the various companies, that obviously that's, they've had the process of enlarging their empire in industrialism, generally all sorts of raw resources, oil and copper, and you know, you name it, they're involved in it. But also institutionally, in a covert way, because obviously that would contradict the idea that we live in a democracy. If people understood, they have been systematically taking over states. Basically, I mean, you know, I give some examples in the booklet of how that's happened in various different ways. They've been taking over and hiding their tracks because, as I say, if people realized. There would be a general outrage everywhere, I think, if people realized the extent to which they've managed to do this.
Yeah, people wouldn't be too, there'd be a lot of grumpy people around. So how have they hidden their tracks then? Because I think you make the point that that most people have sort of come up believing the world is a certain way. And it's shattering potentially to realize that all that they thought is, well, some kind of illusion, some kind of constructed reality that's been presented to them. So how have they done that? How have they successfully done that over such a period of time? These globalists, these empire maintainers.
Well, one of the things they hide behind, of course, is a nation state and the institutions of that nation state, which people are often quite attached to.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they've grown up to think that means us, my family, my friends, everything I know, you know, my way of life. But if you look at Britain in the 19th century, I mean, specifically with the Rothschilds, they became very close to the royal family for a start. Queen Victoria was a bit suspicious of them initially, but they got in with other members of her family. Her son, the Prince Regent, who liked to live the high life, but didn't have enough money to do so, really. Because
okay, that's mum, where the Rothschild helped. They helped.
They became great pals with him, and we'll lend you a few pitch, you know, and then he amassed huge debts, and they helped the royal family buy. They're Balmoral and things like that. You know, they became part of the extended family and remain so today. They were the recently deceased Jacob Rothschild was great friends with the royals in Britain.
Yep.
So that was what, obviously that's one way into the British state. I mean, that you could say that the royal family don't actually run the country. So they were actually also befriending and lending money to people like Randolph Churchill, which is Winston's father, and he remained connected to them. Lloyd George, I think he was more or less blackmailed into going along with their projects because of his notorious affairs with various women. And the method changes. Regards to each different politician, and then there were, of course, there was the financial side, the Bank of England, which they were able to take over. They controlled the world's gold supply to the point that the gold standard was under there was announced. The price of gold globally was announced every morning at the Rothschilds headquarters in London.
Right.
No, and they became the institutions. So behind all these institutions, there was them. There was them. They were lurking there and actually setting the agenda without declaring that they were setting the agenda.
Interesting you saying that history. What I was thinking there is Jeffrey Epstein. Same kind of pattern of play, isn't it?
Funnily enough, yes. Yeah. But funnily enough, I mean, I think this is, it is obviously a continuation. When I say criminocracy, what I really mean is that they're the mafia. They're a very successful mafia that has managed to beat or incorporate all the other mafia gang.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Rothschild family, obviously. They're not that numerous.
It's the network around the whole thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the idea is to have dirt on people, and then you can enforce or influence on people. I wonder what is the status of the royal family? I mean, what do they do apart from a ceremonial thing? What are they involved in?
Well, I mean, we know that Prince Charles, as he was then, King Charles now, was a very close friend with Jimmy Savile, the notorious British paedophile. And then Prince Andrew, his brother, was a client of Epstein. Those are the two leading, most known paedophiles in the world were close friends of the British royal family, which is rather strange. A bit of a coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one association is something, but when you add another one and it's a similar pattern, the odds go down that it's random. Yeah. Were humans ever free of this? There's a big question.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we were there. There were various times in history when there were some pretty tyrannical regimes here and there in the world, but then it wasn't the total blanket coverage that we have today. People were just living their own lives. You know, people were, even in the beginning of the 19th century in Britain, there were people living in villages that never left the village. Or, you know, there were some people went to the market in the next town, but people could live their whole lives growing up, having a family and dying in the same place without any interference. And they left the world the same way as in a pretty much the similar condition as it was when they came into it. So centuries and centuries and centuries. It's only been in the last 300 years or so with the Industrial Revolution that we've been caught up in this nightmarish world where we're ever more controlled and clamped in and deprived of any autonomy and freedom. No, it's been, to me, it's been a descent. The centuries that are usually described as being progress and the flowering of human potential, to me, has been exactly the opposite. We've been stifled and reduced and imprisoned. And that's the way that they want to continue, of course, if their plans are fulfilled as they foresee.
Have people lost an understanding of the true meaning of freedom? Because I see a lot of people, I know a lot of people in the street, you know, they probably think they're free as you'd ever be, you know, they decide to go somewhere, they go somewhere. They might not be able to say a few things and get away with it these days, and they earn their money and life's reasonably good and medical system's reasonably good. That maybe stops a lot of people from going to the next level and questioning the whole thing. So we've kind of in a format that stops a lot of people making any sort of next level thinking, it seems to me.
Yeah, it was definitely the case for most people up until COVID. Well, possibly still is, but I think something changed there with all the restrictions that came in. Which I think were quite frightening in New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah,
from what I saw from a distance, and even I live in France, and it was pretty bad here. You know, you weren't supposed to go out of your house without a little note that you had to write for yourself.
A note from mum.
A note from yourself saying, "Paul is allowed to go to the shops, but he's not going to be more than an hour."
You know? Yeah, and I've told him. Yeah.
So. And at that moment, it was like, oh, hang on. You know, a lot of people must have realized, well, so I'm not, my freedom just to move around is provisional on something else. That there is these people here who can just announce that I haven't got the right to go out anymore, or I haven't got the right to assemble with my friends. And you know, it's suddenly, well, it's not, you're not really free, even on that level, if somebody can decide overnight that that's no longer the case.
Yeah.
But on a larger, on a sort of deeper level, I think the fact that we have to you have to earn money in order to live. And then you have to have money in order to survive in our society. And in order to earn money, you generally have to go and work. And there is a disconnection there for me between the work that you do and the fact that that work allows you to live. Because if your work is you're a farmer or you're you're doing something that is obviously of some use, then yeah, you can say, well, yeah, you've got to make some sort of effort in order to be able to live in the society. But if your work is, you work for an advertising firm or you're in a factory that produces little plastic novelties and Christmas crackers or something, how is that? How is what you're doing of any actual physical use to humankind?
None.
It's only of use to the people who make money out of it.
But that was the leverage used over people to force compliance, and that is loss of income, fundamentally.
Yes, that's true as well. Yeah, so it's another way in which you're not free if you can't just live. I mean, it was an interesting thing I read a few years ago about when the British Empire arrived in Southern Africa. I think it was the Zulus who were just living like people used to live. They lived, they had their cattle they didn't have any money. They didn't need money because they had everything they needed. And then the British state came along and said, well, you've all got to pay taxes now in sterling. In sterling.
Yeah.
So how are we going to get that? Oh, well, you have to come and work for us to earn the money to pay the taxes.
Enslave, basically.
Yeah, it is. It's a form of slavery because you're forced into their system.
Yeah. And you and they end up with the wealth, which you've generated for them. Yeah. Perfect.
Well, yeah, of course. Yes, exactly.
What are we... The WEF, are they an evil... Are they evil, do you think?
Yeah, in short, but they're not the centre of evil, but they're one of the they're one of the fronts. But they don't even pretend to be anything to do with democracy. I mean, they just represent the 1,000 biggest companies on the planet or something like that. And they talk a lot about stakeholder democracy, but what they mean is the stakeholders are them. They think that the real democracy should be the people with the money running things. That's all they're saying. So they're a front for the criminocracy.
How do they get their phrases, their liners like "build back better" distributed to all? We even had our Minister of Finance talking about "build back better." Biden said "build back better." There's a whole bunch of them that said it. How do they get those people to say that, do you think?
Well, that was as I was saying, that was one of the things. One of the phenomena that pointed me towards the obvious existence of this criminocracy, that there is a central governance, without being a government, that somewhere above the level of the WEF that embraces the everything from the World Bank to the World Health Organization, and all the rest of it. Which is using these institutions, which are in fact just its little subsidiaries. Like it's like there's a central office. There's a central office. Central office has said we're going to do this now. We've got this is the script.
Yeah, here's the memo. Yes. But again, they seem to not hold back telling us all what they're doing and thinking. You'd think you'd want to hide that. But that's not hidden. You can go look and see it. It's all there. That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you can find it if you go and look for it. As you've no doubt discovered yourself. Yeah, you go on their websites and you will find all the connections. It's very easy, I found, to write an article exposing the links, because they've got them all at the bottom of the page. You go to the partners section on their website or the funding, and you find they've got it all listed there. I think they just assume that most people are not going to do that. I think they're wrong, actually. I think they vastly underestimated the number of people who've got the wherewithal to go and search, and the motivation to go and search and put the pieces together, especially when they put everybody on a sort of holiday during the COVID years, that people were working from home or
working lots of time on their hands, right?
Yeah, they were sitting there, like, oh, I'll go and have a look at that. So you've got all these amateur sleuths who have discovered the existence of the criminocracy.
And also maybe they thought they had control of the social media, and maybe Elon Musk taking over Twitter was something that came right out of the blue for them.
I don't know. He's very much. I mean, on one hand, yes, we're still able to say these things on Twitter, so which is good, you know. I don't know. I don't know about him because he's very much part of the of that system. I mean,
he'd have to play the game to keep his business interests from being smothered, right?
Yeah. I mean, I just don't have any. I can't see exactly where he's coming from, but I think that must have played a role. I mean, they're panicking now about social media, aren't they? And about, you know, this, the conspiracy theorists. They're just, which means that they're panicking about people realizing what they're doing. Because obviously the only way we're actually going to fight back against them en masse is if people realize what it is that they're up against. If people just go along thinking it's left against right, and it's that person against that one, and, you know, or it's very complicated, and that. That we're not going to be able to focus on what has actually happened. But when people start to see lurking up in the mist of confusion in front of them, they actually see the shape of this thing, this global entity. That is
the blob.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, carry on. Yep.
No, that was it, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because Canada has got a bill on about, I think, to go through their parliament, which concentrates on hate speech, very heavy penalties for exercising, some would say, free speech. I saw Rishi Sunak responding to George Galloway's Rochdale by-election win, and just the rhetoric from Sunak was almost scorched earth. It was like, it did sound slightly panicky. Are we coming to a tipping point, do you think? Is that very far away?
I got that impression from from Sunak's speech, which was very peculiar, wasn't it? It was like a sort of declaration of war on the British public, I thought. He was complaining about an election result. He was complaining that an election result was a threat to democracy.
Yeah, it was a bizarre thing. It really was to listen to. Like, I was wondering, do you know what you're actually saying here, mate? You know?
It was peculiar. And because this sort of agenda that they're rolling out everywhere, hate speech, yeah, they love that word, hate and extremism and far right and, you know, which is just, this is all just words and smears leveled against people that are challenging and criticizing what they're doing. I mean, I'm sure they've got the, they probably will pass a lot of the laws saying that you're not allowed to say this or that. But it's too late if people, I mean, that just helps people understand what they're doing as well. The more they do that, the more people say, well, why? You know, why aren't we allowed to criticize these people, or why aren't we allowed to say this? And so they're going to be in a situation like under some sort of tin pot dictatorship, or like under the Soviet Union, where the people know what's going on. They know they're living in a dictatorship.
Yeah,
and that's not going to last, is it? Because they've always depended on people not knowing, and then just going along with it.
Can you see any like confrontation here, or can these things be resolved peacefully? Because it's an epic, it's turning into an epic struggle, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean it's epic on a historical scale, and I'm more and more thinking that it's going to collapse from within. The people that are working for them don't necessarily know that they're working for the criminocracy. I don't think some of them might do, but they think, as I said, they think they're working for their country. They think they were working for democracy, or if they're part of this sort of fake opposition, you know, the sort of fake left that I've written about. They think they're working for the cause, you know, and they're Well, I think they're trying to save the planet because they're getting involved in that climate scam, you know. So that people are, you know, they're not willingly, they're not saying, yes, I'm going to advance the cause of the dictatorial global criminocracy and suppress the rights of my fellow countrymen and so on. They're not. And if they do realize, because they do, they're part of the same society of us, they will hear about it if everybody else knows about it, because their friends and their family members will be saying, oh, yeah, you do realize it. At the very least, they're going to be less enthusiastic in their work, aren't they? And they're going to, maybe they'll just start dragging their heels and, you know, throwing a few little spanners into the works. And I can see a sort of desertion from within the system being the way that it could collapse, that it doesn't work anymore. And I think maybe that's happening already, which is why they're panicking a bit, to be honest.
Yeah. How do you see, let's say we work through this, how do you see, you know, civilization moving ahead after something like this? We're talking about almost reinventing the way we kind of do things, right? I mean, if this is where we've got to under the criminocracy, we need to design things so that isn't so likely again.
Yeah, and I think the first step would be decentralization to me.
Oh, right.
Obviously, decentralizing from cutting off from the global institutions, and then giving power back to as local a level as possible. And that's real democracy, when people can decide how they want to live. And the rest, if we had democracy, real democracy, that wouldn't happen again, because democracy can never lead us down a path that is only in the interests of a tiny, powerful ruling class, unless it's a fake democracy, which we're in now, you know.
Yeah.
So and I would depend on that level, that decentralized local participative democracy level to set the course for the future. I think that people would decide that we produce what we need rather than what might make lots of money, because there wouldn't be that situation where somebody's going to get very rich of it. So we'd say, we need to produce this and that, but do we really need to destroy this area in order to achieve this? Do we need all these big projects? And people would say, no, you know, we just want to live a nice environment, peacefully, without outside interference, concentrate on bring up our children and enjoying ourselves. You know, these should be the...
How quaint. The aims of life. It sounds great, though, boy.
I don't suppose... Well, I may see the start of it, I suppose, at my age. But I'd love to live in that sort of society. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all would. And are you, with everything you know, how optimistic are you about? Well, I mean, the long-term future. How long is a piece of string? But near term, next 10, 15 years, you think we'll, get through that okay?
I think we can. I mean, my sort of optimism is provisional, and that we all need to make a bit of an effort here. We need to do all that we can to stop this nightmare smart city dictatorship from seizing control of everything for the future, you know. And although it would crash in the long run, I don't think it would. What they have in mind just physically wouldn't work. I don't think we even want to start on that course because of the damage that it would do to nature and to people and to our well-being. So yeah, I know that we could bring it down, because there's so many of us. There's so many more of us. There are a tiny number of people that are actively involved in trying to continue this system, and there are 8 billion people in this world. And
too many, apparently, according to the criminocracy. That's too many.
Yeah, too many. Yeah, they just want to open themselves, don't they? Yeah, yeah. Just have a few slaves and robots to look after them. And
Of course, a battle is looming with the use of AI. We've got to be ready for that, right? I mean, we've got to be on guard that what we see and what we hear might not actually be real, especially through.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's already been the case to a large extent, but yeah, even more so now. Yeah, literally, it could be something that you think is a video proving something won't be. No. I mean, AI is a big threat anyway. I mean, it's just one of the. I know it's people find it fascinating and interesting, but it is actually a tool of control.
Well, it's a tool of chaos, isn't it? It's a tool of potential chaos because if you don't know which way's up anymore. You're going to get factions insisting something's true, others saying it's not. No, the truth just dissolves away unless you're right there when it happens. And even now, they'll tell you, you've seen it with your own eyes, it's still not true, you know. So it's crazy time. Hey, it's been really interesting talking with you, Paul Kudinek. If people are interested, you can go and read Paul at Winter Oak. And I'm just looking at the latest piece. Been up on the 16th of Feb, pretty sure it's the latest, Our Quest for Freedom, Explaining, Proposing. You read that and all those other articles. And thanks for coming on, Paul. Really interesting to hear what you had to say.
No, thank you, Paul. Yeah, it was a good chat.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.